Get ready for a week-long celebration of music, community, and fabulous fun with Joy Radiothon 2024. Joy has the largest collection of rainbow podcast content in the world, and you can help keep us out loud and proud by donating during Joy Radiothon 2024. Just go to joy.org.au/radiothon. Mark it in your calendars because Joy Radiothon returns June 1st to 7th. And remember, we all flourish with joy.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycasts.
Real life is scarier than anything we can dream of. And we dream such frightening things. Sci-fi and scream.
Be afraid.
Be very afraid on Joy 94.9.
And welcome to Sci-fi and Scream, Wednesday, October 20. 2010. And thanks very much again to David and Jade for A Different Strokes. Excellent guys. Now, tonight on Sci-Fi and Scream, we are in a world full of cult. I'm going to be looking at cult films especially this evening. And we just heard the track from Deliverance, the, of course, iconic Dueling Banjos. And that was performed by Eric Weisberg and Steve Mandel, made very famous, of course, because of the 1972 cult American horror thriller film that was produced and directed by John Borman back in 1972. And, of course, the principal cast were John Voight, Burt Reynolds, Ronnie Cox and Ned Beatty. That was his debut film, in fact, John Borman, and it was based on a 1970 novel of the same name by the American author James Dickey, who actually had a small role in the film itself. In 2008, Deliverance was selected for the preservation in the United States National Film Registry by the Library of Congress as being culturally, historically, and aesthetically significant. I don't know what you think, but tonight we are looking at cult films, and some of them will be The American Astronaut, which is more recent. It came out in 2001 by Corey McAbee, and The Billy Nayer Show, who produced that wonderful sci-fi operatic, I suppose you call it, musical opera. We'll be looking at films like that. Of course, Rocky Horror Picture Show, Brazil, The Crow, Donnie Darko, Blade Runner, naturally. Now I'm joined this evening by a guest who's sitting in with me, Amal. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. It's nice to be here.
Now, do you have a cult favourite film?
You know, I thought you were going to ask me the question and I thought, what shall I say? And
what
I said,
are you going to say?
Life experience have sometimes been like a cult experience.
Cult film.
Cult film. One that comes to mind is the Hitchcock. The one in the bar.
Psycho?
Psycho.
Yeah, that's a classic.
That's a classic. So
And it does have a sort of a cult following. I saw it recently again for, I don't know, the umpteenth time on the big screen here in Melbourne with a live orchestra. And, yeah, it was pretty amazing having a symphonic orchestra playing the soundtrack.
That would have been great playing
the score, I should say.
Wow.
Yeah.
Awesome.
So, yeah, so that was just some Dueling Banjos by Weisenberg and Mandel from Deliverance. Now, there are so many great cult films out there. There's Freaks, which is going back to 1932. There, of course, is the Rocky Horror Picture Show from 1975.
That's a good favourite. Yeah, that's a favourite.
What do you like about that one? What do you think makes it a cult film?
I think the fact that it can be played in resurrected for many a times and been turned into productions and stuff. And I think the fact that it's quite kitsch, it's quite camp, it's a story out of the ordinary. Very queer.
Very queer.
And just this fascination of something alternative, something different.
Mm.
Even the storyline,
That's true. And other ones that, I think will make the grade as being a cult film now would be ones like Repo Man, which came out in 1984, Brazil, which was an early film by Terry Gilliam.
Was that released in the 80s?
That was also released in the 80s.
I think I remember it. And it was sort of quite full. Yeah, full on.
Yeah, a sort of a science fiction fantasy.
Fantasy, yes.
But due to poor marketing, hype and buzz around it meant that when it came out on video, it was a very, very popular film. So it became a cult film after its, a couple of years after it was released, because it was a flop. Yeah. One of Terry's several flops he's had in his time, unfortunately.
Okay.
But when it came out as a video rental, it was probably one of the most popular in the 80s at the time. Of course, The Crow.
Oh, yes, The Crow.
Especially with this unusual circumstances surrounding the death of the lead actor. And that gave it a sort of a cult status, I think.
Status, yeah.
And Blade Runner, naturally. Financially, it was unsuccessful when Ridley Scott, the director, first had it released on its initial release. But with all the different DVD features and the new director's cuts and so forth, it's become much more popular with time.
There was one that comes to mind, Jack Nicholson, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Yes, yeah.
That was definitely one that sort of...
The Shining too, I think.
The Shining.
The Shining, yeah. Because they've all got, well, Jack Nicholson, who's probably one of the few actors who's been in a number of cult type of films.
Yeah.
Now, according to online, what makes a cult film a cult film or a picture a cult classic? Apparently, it has to acquire a highly devoted but specific type of fan group or fan base. And often cult films have failed to achieve fame outside of their small fan bases. However, there have been exceptions, of course, and the crossover into mainstream. But many cult films basically start out as duds or complete failures, but because of their uniqueness and because they're, in a way, they're a bit of a failure, they get a following. They seem
to
attract
Brazil.
People. Hence Brazil. Yep, hence Blade Runner as well.
Blade Runner, yeah.
Now, cult films often become the source of a thriving, almost obsessive and elaborate subculture of fandom, and hence the analogy to cults. However, not every film with a devoted fan base is necessarily a cult film. So sometimes a cult film has to have limited but very special appeal, noted appeal, and they're often known to be very eccentric, outlandish even, totally bizarre sort of plot lines, storylines, and these are the things that, I don't know why, they register with some type of people and become
cult.
Followed and become the cult film that they are.
Yeah.
Often they're considered controversial films because they take a step outside of the normal narrative, like I was saying, type of plot lines and storylines and methodology, and often they will use unconventional technical not techniques and aesthetics. And a film I'll talk about a bit later will be American Astronaut, because that very much so takes the cult genre to another dimension altogether. So, yeah. So you're listening to Sonia and Amal, who's our guest this evening, on Sci-Fi and Scream on Joy 94.9. And we'll play some music now from The American Astronaut. So stay tuned to Sci-Fi and Scream. And this is Sonia, and Amal is sitting across the table, I was going to say, here on Sci-Fi and Scream on Joy 94.9. We were just listening to the wonderful Princess Leia just then, Carrie Fisher, who's been in town or is still in town at the moment. So cheers, that was wonderful to hear her voice there. And we played a couple of tracks from The American Astronaut. One was called Shaving. And the other one was Ceres Walk, and that's by the Billy Nair Show. Now, the director of The American Astronaut is also a musician, artist and performer, Corey McAbee. And we actually did interview him in January, I think it was, earlier this year on Sci-Fi and Scream, which was very, very exciting. He was releasing his second film project, or their second film project, Stingray Sam. But The American Astronaut, of course, that came out almost 10 years ago, believe it or not, 2001. It's described as a space western musical, directed and starring Corey McAbee, as I said. Now, the film was released on DVD in 2005, and the band he plays with and contributes all of the music is The Billy Nair Show, which is helmed by McAbee. Now, he's written and performed, of course, the whole of this film. Now, the film is set in a fictitious past in which space travel is pioneered by roughnecks. The logic of space travel is never addressed in the film, and the technology that was designed for the film appears as if it could be repaired with a hammer. And those are quotation marks. Now, Samuel Curtis is the character played by Corey McAbee, and the Blueberry Pirate, which is played by Joshua Taylor, who's also in The Billy Nayer Show. So you probably get the drift here that it's very much a, what would you call it, all hands on deck, made from scratch type of film. It's shot in a sort of a sepia black and white through the entire film, and they use a lot of still photography to emote space travel and movement because of the very, very low budget.
Who was actually in that?
He was in it himself. There's no big names in this.
Yeah.
Probably the closest would be Rocco Sisto, who has appeared in things like The Sopranos in the past. But even then, these aren't big household names.
A known cast.
A very unknown. But they've did it all themselves. And it has a very strange story of a man called this Curtis character, who basically goes to one planet to pick up a real live girl. It's a cloned girl of a small stature, which we never see, in a box. And he has to deliver that to the planet Jupiter, which is all filled with men who are minors. There aren't any females. And he wants to swap the real live girl, as she's called, for the boy who saw a woman's breast. These are the sort of names of the characters. It's very, very quirky. It's totally quirky. It feels like a Western.
Wow.
And so, unfortunately, he's been chased by this character, who's played by the amazing Rocco Sisto. And this character is just out to get Curtis. And we don't really know why, but apparently it's something that Curtis did many, many moons ago. Professor Hess is the name of the character, and he's hot on his trail. He's like a nemesis or his doppelganger. Now, the spacecraft is a train, a steam train. But all we see is still pictures of a steam train floating in some sort of space.
It's not a remake of another movie, is it?
No, it's a completely new idea.
It just sort of
completely.
There was a movie, this is going yonkers back, and it starred Yul Brynner called, I think, Westworld.
Ah, yes, yeah.
Do you remember that?
I remember that one. That was out there.
Oh, yeah.
That's got a sort of a cult following. Now, we have had an SMS
from
Steve the Truckee. What does Steve have to say? Do you want to read that one?
Okay, Steve's favourite film was The Matrix. And he's writing on his SMS that it was technically up to date when it was released, which it was, trendy. And Steve the Truckee thinks that Keanu Reeves is a hottie.
There you go,
Steve.
There you go, Keanu. Good luck with that.
Thank you, Steve.
I wouldn't have thought of Matrix as an actual cult film in a way because it became so big. But I guess the first one did have sort of cultish elements, particularly now everyone, you know, follows it very closely. And
I think, yeah, like technically it seemed quite advanced in its you know, most like its shots and so forth.
Yeah,
that had not been done, correct me if I'm wrong, prior to the movie showing. So some of that was shot up and that was actually shot in Australia. Because some of the characters were
Australian actors, I think.
Yeah, and I think some New Zealanders.
New Zealanders playing Australians, playing Americans.
Yeah.
It's always the way, isn't it? Now, there's so many other cult films that I was trying to rack my brain over. There's Santa Sangre. There's the first Evil Dead, although some say the whole series is by the Raimi brothers is a cult. But the Evil Dead, the first one especially, was very popular in the 1980s. I think it was one of the most rented videos around. Have you ever seen that one?
Which one was
that? The Evil Dead.
Rings a bell.
Yeah, they go to a cabin in the forest, a group of young people, you know, it's always young people getting into trouble.
Yeah.
And then one by one they get taken out by trees and turned into almost zombie-fied monsters, and particularly the female characters.
That zombie feel, that sort of killing sort of scenario always is always one of the lines behind cult films. Would you agree?
Yeah, possession, stuff like that. Getting possessed is pretty
Film that comes to mind, Reservoir Dogs.
Oh, yeah. Especially the segment in there where he, has the razor blade.
Oh, my gosh. I just realised that I shouldn't have had... I went into a movie, had jelly beans with me, and had to go to the bathroom because it was like...
That was a little too strong for you.
It was too strong for my stomach. It was like, the sun is not my best friend.
No.
So,
obviously not. Now, Legend's another film by Ridley Scott. That was a huge flop, made in the 80s again, starring a very young Tom Cruise.
Legend. Oh, yes.
Yes. Fantasy sort of film.
What was it?
Marvellous film.
What was it set around, like?
Unicorns in the forest. It had that magical sort of fairy tale element, fantasy element. And, you know, the prince and the princess and, well, the pauper guy rescuing and, you know, being the knight in shining armour sort of storyline. And it had some incredible sets and incredible costumes.
Well, probably be one that I'd have a look
at. Tim Curry was in it, actually.
So it's
Satan.
Called Legend.
Legend, just Legend. Massive flop, cost millions of it at the time.
And Tim Curry was best known for...
Frankenfurter, of course.
Yeah.
The Rocky Horror Picture Rocky Show, Horror Picture 1975. Show. Yep. Now, he's marvellous in this film called Legend. If you haven't seen it, you should really... Yeah, take some time out and check it out, definitely.
Yeah, have a look at trying to get the
A Clockwork Orange, of course, would be a cult classic, I believe, and it's my number one film of all time. I mean, most people who know me know that, and they get sick of me harping on about it, but seriously, even the wonderful Moog soundtrack, if you can get hold of it, is a cult, has cult classics written all over it. Have you ever seen the film, A Clockwork Orange?
I think I might have.
Stanley Kubrick...
The name's, it rings a bit. I know that it's a classic.
Yeah, it's a demented, sort of violent classic.
Yeah.
But it's a great film. Now, one that was mentioned recently when I was at the Worldcon was the 1984 classic, The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai Across the Eighth Dimension.
What a name.
That is a great name.
That's a mouthful, but what a name.
That's got classic written all over it, or cult status, which it has.
Oh, yeah.
There's always been talk of remakes, but no, doesn't happen.
What was that about?
Well, it stars Peter Weller, of course, as Buckaroo Banzai, and he's an whose latest experiment opens the door into an eighth dimension and unwittingly starts an interstellar battle for the world. Yes. And it was an Entertainment Weekly. It was ranked as number 43 in their top 50 cult films. You're listening to Sonia and Amal on Sci-Fi and Squeam. Sci-Fi and Squeam and Sonia and Amal here now. And we're looking at A World of Cult. It's so hard to fit them all in, but I thought I would put that track from the first Scream, the 1996 one. And that is music from that actual film. And that was Catherine. And with Whisper. Now, Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, of course, also appear on this soundtrack. It's a great soundtrack. And it's got Sister Machine Gun and Bird Brain as well. And Moby, an early Moby track. Now, that came out in 96, and certainly that's had quite a strong following. In fact, Scream 4 is due to be out very soon, I believe, beginning of next year. And they're bringing back the original cast member, Neve Campbell. So it'll be great to see that.
She was great.
Yeah, she's a fantastic Canadian actress.
There was another one that she was in, Witchcraft? Was it called?
The Craft. Many moons ago, yeah.
Yeah, that was freaky.
Sort of the same era. I think that came out in 97 or 98. But the first Scream was pretty amazing.
Yes.
Especially, you know, Drew Barrymore being gutted like a fish. the very first scenes. Brilliant stuff. Brilliant, scary stuff.
She's great. I love
And Drew is fantastic.
Yeah, she's great.
It was such a small part, but it was a real sellable.
Yeah.
Really sold the film, that opening part.
Do you know who else was in that movie?
Skeet Ulrich was in that film.
For him.
Of course. He played the bad boy. Courtney Cox, very young Courtney Cox. And, of course, David Arquette. And of course, they hooked up later, didn't they?
Okay.
They've kind of unhooked now, but that's where I think it all started.
Started.
Started with a scream. Ended with a bang.
Boom.
Boom. All right. Now, I will play some more music, but I'm going to also mention Alan Parker's hybrid mystery horror film, a classic from 1987, and that's Angel Heart, starring the wonderful Mickey Rourke and Robert De Niro as Louis Cypher. And of course, it's Lucifer. Get it? Now, it fared poorly at the box office, only just breaking even. But despite that, again, thanks to the miracles of VHS, video, the good old days, it became a cult classic. Ever since then, it went from strength to strength.
Who was the female lead in that? Do you remember?
Female lead in that was...
Was it Lisa Bonet?
Lisa Bonet, that's correct.
The girl from The Cosby Show.
That's right. She's all growing up in that
She's
one.
She's all growing up, yeah.
There was a lot of controversy yeah,
over it.
Over
yes.
the miscegenation and, yeah.
Because it was nudity. Quite full on.
It was full on between her and Mickey.
Yeah.
And it had a very spooky tone. Michael Saracen, cinematography, of course. A score by Trevor Jones. Wonderful, wonderful blend of genres. And two of the film's producers, Andrew G. Vanya and Mario Casa, also produced the cult film Jacob's Ladder, which had a similar narrative structure as well as a twist in the end. So it's those twists in the end that often make a cult film, according yeah. to some. Now,
I think the more unusual, the more cult status.
Yes,
it will become. It can become.
Yeah, if you build it, they will come. Yeah, yep, sort of thing. Now, Eraserhead, of course, was a fabulously dark and seriously weird film from the seriously wonderful David Lynch, of course, written and produced and directed by him. And music. He also did the music soundtrack for some of that. He edited it all by himself, and that was released in 1977. 89 minutes long, and every single minute of it is torture. I don't know if you've ever seen it. Eraserhead.
No.
It's torturous. It's just amazing. It's in black and white. It is considered an American surrealist film more than a horror.
Okay.
So it's kind of got those horror aspects, but it's so the plot again is just so bizarre and doesn't make any sense really whatsoever. But I think that's what's made it a cult film. Now it follows the short period of life of Henry Spencer, and that's Jack Nance, the late Jack Nance, who's appeared in a lot of David Lynch films and Twin Peaks as well. Now he's a printer on vacation. Yeah, he's an amazing guy, but unfortunately he died not so long ago.
Okay.
Henry discovers that his estranged girlfriend, Mary X, that's her name, has given birth to a bizarrely deformed, white, pussy-like baby. It just has a mouth and nothing else. It's pretty bizarre. And it screams all the time through the whole film. It's screaming.
You know what I'm thinking about at this very moment? Milk
what?
Bars.
Milk bars.
I don't think I want another one.
No. This deformed, bizarre baby, like, he marries her, and after a brief time living together, she leaves him and the baby behind. And a bizarre sequence of events follow that have little or no reason. We don't know what the reason is for any of it, basically. Now, it's polarised and baffled many, many people. However, in 2004, the film was deemed culturally, historically and aesthetically significant by the United States Library of Congress, just as the way that Deliverance, I mentioned earlier, was, and has been selected for preservation in the National Film Registry. Lynch himself has called it a dream of dark and troubled things. He also calls it his most spiritual film, and he is actually a devout Zen follower of Zen and meditation.
Oh, wow.
Yes, yes. Now, Eraserhead is set in an industrial centre rife with urban decay. Everything's breaking down. It's quite steampunk in a way, very early steampunk. And it's just got that gritty, grimy, greasy feeling about it, the whole look of the film.
Mm.
I actually saw it on a large screen and it was unbearable. Totally. I walked out at the end thinking, what on earth have I just been watching? Because I'd heard about it for years and I'd never had the guts to go along and see it. And it was, yeah, it was a very hard film to sit through. But I can understand why people would think it was culturally significant. But, yeah, there are things you want to do with that mutant baby that just isn't right. Just isn't right. And it's full of dream sequences, so it is a very interesting film indeed. Now, you're listening to Sonia and Amal here on Sci-Fi and Squeam on Joy 94.9. Welcome back to Sci-Fi and Squeam on Joy 94.9, just like Paul just said there. And that was an amazing little bit of a remake there of Too Drunk to Fuck, and that was by Nouvelle Vague from the Grindhouse Robert Rodriguez film Planet Terror, which I think would probably be considered in the future a cult classic.
A cult classic.
Now, it's a twisted sort of zombie film, I guess you call it, and highly, what would you call it, highly garish, very camp, very choreographed, bloody and gory, and, yeah, quite humorous, and with a great soundtrack. And like David Lynch, Robert Rodriguez plays a lot of his own musical instruments for his soundtracks. I believe he plays a guitar, the drums, saxophone, and Lynch plays the saxophone and I believe composes with piano. So it's interesting how these guys, including the fellow Corey McAbee who does The American Astronaut and Stingray Sam, he also plays and composes the music for his own film. So yeah, these guys are definitely very, very multitaskers.
I have one, and it's come to mind.
Mm-hmm.
The one that Jane Fonda was in.
Barbarella. Yeah. Barbarella's fantastic. I don't know how many times I've seen it. But
yeah.
I think I've seen it probably about a dozen times now.
Yeah.
But it's an awesome film. And the soundtrack for that is wicked as well.
Wow.
Brilliant soundtrack. I love it how she always trips over the set. There's a great scene there where she's, I don't know if it's deliberate, but it looks like she's tripping over. It's totally weird.
And how about our friend Freddy Krueger, the Friday the 13th?
Oh, yeah.
Genre of films.
Yeah, they've got a bit of a following.
Because what are they up to? Or what have they gone up to? Friday the 13th.
Well, you're talking Nightmare on Elm Street.
Yes.
So they've actually rebooted the whole thing, but apparently it's not that wonderful.
No.
So they've redone the whole thing starting from the beginning. It's interesting. What will happen? Who knows what they will reboot next? Do we really need them? Maybe that's a question we can ask people too, is if there was a cult classic film they wanted redone, what would it be?
Interesting. I think that'd be a question.
That would be a question, I think. Be interesting.
Interesting.
Now, another one I wanted to mention, because I only thought about it this week, and that was The Last House on the Left, the 1972 version. I haven't seen the 2006 version, but I believe it's still as creepy as ever. But the 1972 horror film was written and directed by Wes Craven and produced by Sean S. Cunningham as well. And the story is based on the 13th century Swedish ballad Tore's Dotter Wanga, I don't know if I've said that correctly, which was also adapted into a 1960 Swedish film, The Virgin Spring, which of course is an Ingmar Bergman film. Now, the 1972 Last House on the Left is written by Wes Craven, as I said, and it was intended to be a graphic hardcore film, with all the actors and crew being committed to filming it as such. However, after shooting began in 1971, the hard decision was made to edit it down to a much softer style of film. The script was written originally as Night of Vengeance and has never been released. Only a brief glimpse is visible in the featurette Celluloid Crime of the Century, and a sample is available on DVD, apparently. Now, there's some rare scenes in the film, small cuts from the original, completely uncut 91-minute film, still pretty rare to get hold of. It was banned until very recently in the UK, up to about 2005, and there are some scenes in there that are very disturbing. There's a lesbian rape scene, for example, a scene which one of the creators of the film and some fans, actually, of the movie thought they'd gone too far when two female victims are forced to commit sexual acts on each other in the woods. This forced lesbian rape scene has been found in later years and added later to the DVD features, but for many years was only thought to exist as a photographic still from the film. There you go. Yeah, there's a few sort of unusual sexual horrific acts that are committed against people, women on women type of things. So it's not for everyone. It's certainly not for the squeamish, but I do recommend it actually because it's sort of like is a mirror, I guess, of what was happening in the United States at the time with the Watergate and everything else and the Vietnam War reaching its worst part. Its peak was in the early 70s as far as fatalities go and the mess that was being created and also the anti-war feeling and post-Manson murders and end of the hippie era. I mean, things were just spiraling out of control culturally within the United States. And Wes Craven has actually said himself that, he was looking to the dark side of suburbia, really, and what would happen. Because basically, you need to see the film either versions to see what I'm getting at. It does remind me a little bit of Funny Games, which probably has got a bit of a cult following now. Funny Games, made by the wonderful Austrian filmmaker Michael Haneke, where two young men go to borrow a cup of sugar and knock off a whole family next door. Yeah, it's sort of random acts of horror and random acts of murder. Yeah, worth checking out.
Worth checking out.
I'm going to go to a track now. I so like The American Astronaut, so I'm going to play this one on Sci-Fi and Scream on Joy 94.9. Sci-Fi and Scream, Joy 94.9, and that's taken from The American Astronaut, Girl with the Vagina Made of Glass.
That soundtrack was camp. I was thinking to myself, is that a song for the drag queens or the drag kings to perform? I just think that was just so
I'd kitsch. Love to see someone perform that.
Yeah, that was just so
give
cab.
That a go.
That was cab.
So they produce all their own music and for that film. And look, it is played occasionally here in Melbourne, usually at the Acme. So if you have a chance to see it sometime, maybe look them up and have a look for that and see if there's anything there, any sessions available. Now, we've had some great SMSs. We had one from Charlene, and Charlene, thank you very much. She says that Blade Runner is probably her most favourite cult sci-fi sort of film, and I'd have to agree. It's pretty amazing. I haven't seen it as much as some people I know, but
I haven't seen it. I thought maybe she could be talking about the cartoon Blade Runner.
No.
I
don't think
Let's
so.
Let's not go there.
Oh, dear me. We have a novice. No, I'm just kidding.
Thanks.
Now, another one is a Belgian one, because we've been looking at so many American ones and English ones, but Man Bites Dog, I don't know if you've ever seen this. It's about a Belgian serial killer, and it's a mockumentary. It's a huge hit in so-called underground art house cinema. Now, this character, Ben Nui, is a charismatic serial killer who discusses at length whatever comes to mind, be it architecture, philosophy, or classical music, while killing people. And the film runs that a film crew made up of three other guys join him in his sadistic adventures, recording him as like a fly on the wall sort of style, hence the mockumentary aspect. He takes them to meet his family and friends while explaining at length the craft of his killing sprees. It was directed by Remy Belvaux, André Bonzel, Benoît Paul Vaudour, who stars as a serial killer. He was also one of the directors. And it's entirely shot in black and white and was produced on a shoestring budget by these four student filmmakers. They were students at the time. The genesis of the idea came from shooting a documentary without any money. Now, the film is rated NC-17 in the United States, Motion Picture Association of America, because of the graphic nature. I'm not sure what the rating was here, but I know that in New Zealand it played and played and played, wow. But like the Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Now, we've just had an SMS come in from Sal. Sal says that Lost Boys and the Rocky Horror Show were her favourites.
Excellent. Yeah, look, I can watch Rocky Horror a number of times if I'm feeling in the mood.
Yep. And Lost Boys.
And Lost Boys. I haven't seen that in a while, but I think that's
they showed that a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
That is a classic.
That's a classic. Very good. Look, it's been a great show. It's been very good having you on here helping me out, Amal.
Thank you.
Hopefully you can do it again.
Yes, hopefully.
If all goes well.
I'll slip you my number later.
Yeah, it'll be cool. So we've looked at a few cult films. There's just so many. And, Yeah, there's always one. As soon as you think of one, 10 minutes later, you're thinking of another one. And I guess what makes them what they are is they're like little wee lights and you know, that you sort of are drawn to. And they sort of give one hope that there's an alternate to the mainstream of Hollywood films or, you know, regular sort of films. And cult films, certainly for me, have kept me going in many, many situations. There are some that aren't genre films that are cult films, but because we deal in genre and sci-fi and horror, pretty much stuck to those ones. Mm. But if I went on about all the other cult films out there, well, we'd probably need a six-hour show.
And more like a six-hour show version of an encyclopedia.
Yeah, something like
that.
Look, it's been great having you on, like I said.
Thank you. It's been great.
And we're going to wrap it up shortly. And Aaron's on next with Raise Your Flag here on Joy 94.9. You have been listening to Sonia and Amal on Sci-Fi on Scream, and that's Joy's only LGBTIQ horror sci-fi show. But I will play a track before I go. What am I going to play?
What's
from Saw,
track?
Actually. The first Saw.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
The Saw movie.
The first one, definitely.
That
amazing.
Yeah. There was No words.
No words for that one. Yes. All right. Well, stay tuned and keep on listening to Joy and 94.9.
Thank you for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9.
This podcast was produced by Joy Media. You can support Joy's diverse sound and diverse community this June by donating to Joy Radiothon 2024. Go to joy.org.au/radiothon. And remember, we all flourish with joy.